Last week on Freakonomics Radio, we were asking people to name the one thing that distinguishes humans from other animals.
In a sentence, the one thing that makes humans human is our ability to think in the future tense.
And that is
Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks, former chief rabbi of Britain and the Commonwealth, currently university teacher, author, thinker.
Thinking in the future tense. I like that notion. Not sure I buy it entirely. Squirrels gather nuts for the winter. Is the median squirrel really worse at saving for the future than the median human? In fact, many of the distinguishing marks of humanity we've been hearing are, well, arguable. Today, we'll get into those arguments.
Yeah, we did experiments on this. Yeah.
You're saying that Homo economicus is really, the idea of that is probably more fully present in animals other than humans then, yeah?
Yeah, you should leave out the homo part and you're going okay.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio, the show that explores the hidden side of everything. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
We've been looking at what one trait truly sets humans apart from other animals, especially this trait.
I mean, as an economist, I would say cooperative trade.
That is the UCLA economist Keith Chen. But Chen's own research, as he was telling us last week, suggests that monkeys, at least, are capable of carrying out what looks like economic activity. But let's remember, monkeys are genetically pretty close to humans. And further, those were nice, tight lab experiments in which Chen spent many months teaching the monkeys how to use money. What if we were to take this question of animal economics out of the lab and into nature?
Okay. My name is Ben Krehr, and I'm a journalist living in Berlin. I write mainly about science and wildlife.
Krehr wrote a fascinating article for Bloomberg called The Secret Economic Lives of Animals. We started our conversation with the question we've been asking everyone else. So as someone who's written about animals a lot and who is a human animal yourself, what would you say is the one thing that makes humans different from all other animals?
Such a hard question. I think a lot of biologists would say that, you know, that we do have a lot in common with animals, so that it's not really clear where to draw this line, you know, that understanding ourselves as animals provides us probably a way to understand other animals as well. So I think these lines are actually getting harder to define, that what is animal and what is human. It used to seem more distinct.
Getting harder because we're learning more about animal behavior?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And human behavior as well, and just what is intelligence, what produces intelligence in animals, and finding it in unexpected places. And, you know, in animals, that, you know, things like octopuses that are so distant from us evolutionarily, but that exhibit behaviors that we would categorize as extremely intelligent.
Ben Krehr's pursuit of animal economics began where many great stories begin, in the footnotes.
I was researching something else and I saw a reference to biological market theory, and it struck me as a contradiction or an oxymoron, a biological market, because a market is a realm of economic activity and only humans engage in economic activity, I thought. So I followed the footnotes back. It led me to...
I'm Ronald Noy.
Ronald Noy.
I'm a professor here at the University of Strasbourg in France.
And are you technically a biologist or some other kind of ist?
I'm a pure biologist, yeah. I'm a primatologist, to be more exact.
Talk to me for just a moment about why you began to study animal behavior and how you got started.
I'm afraid I have to say that as many young biologists, you're just attracted to animals because they're fun to look at. And I was attracted to mammals because they are just nice and hairy and whatever. This is still the reason that most of my students ask me to do primates. If you ask them why, what are your questions, they go silent. And actually, they want adventure, they want Africa, they want nice animals. And I must admit that was my basic reason as well as a young boy. As soon as you get into the university, of course, you're confronted with the fact that you need to ask real questions.
The real questions Noé had were about cooperation in primates. He got his start as a grad student, observing chimpanzees at the Arnhem Zoo in the Netherlands. By the early 1980s, Noé was observing baboons in the wild in Kenya. In these baboon groups, alpha males had access to females and kept the lower-ranking males away. But Noé found that lower-ranking males could band together to challenge the alphas.
And if you are successful at that, then you have a certain time exclusive access to that female. It's called the consortship. And the low-ranking males only have a chance if they cooperate together and chase the high-ranking male away from that female.
But there's a dilemma. If two low-ranking males work together to steal a female from an alpha, only one of them could mate with the female.
You can't split a female in two.
So how was a decision made? How could this cooperation work? At the time, there were, in biology circles, two primary theories of cooperation. One was kin selection, which involves helping out a closely related individual to make it more likely for your own genes to be passed on. But the baboons Noé was observing weren't that closely related. The other theory was called reciprocal altruism. You scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. According to this theory, the lower-ranking males should alternate who gets access to the female after they've chased away the alpha male.
If you don't alternate, then the one that did not have the female often enough should walk away from it, should not accept that.
No, I was observing three baboons.
Ben Crayer again.
They were all low-ranking, but the most powerful one was named Stu. He was sort of the best partner. And what he realized was that when Stu and one of the other baboons successfully challenged a higher-ranking male and drove him off and then had the opportunity to mate with a female, Stu was getting most of the mating time. They weren't sharing it 50-50.
And the other male still formed coalitions with him. And that started me thinking about how the heck is this possible?
Noé realized that reciprocal altruism could not explain the behavior he was seeing. It had to be something else.
And as Noah observed them more closely, what he realized, Stu was like a really clever animal. Stu was more valuable to each of those baboons than they were to each other, because they weren't as strong. And Stu realized that he could basically get more mating time after a successful challenge, because if the guy he was with tried to say, well, I want 50-50, Stu would just leave him and then go work with the other one. And that one would probably be happier to accept maybe 30% of the time with Stu than not have Stu at all. And so what Noah realized is that there was this element of partner choice going on.
Partner choice. That was Ronald Noé's big idea. Stu could choose between partners, effectively bargaining to raise the price of his cooperation. And with that insight, Noé realized that what he was observing was an economic transaction.
Partner choice is what drives markets, what drives trade, what drives everything, because you force the others to outbidding competition. And that's basically what a market is.
When Noé published his research in the early 1990s, he called this situation a biological market.
It was essentially one of the first times biologists have really tried to apply economic ideas to nature.
The idea didn't go over so well with biologists or the big biology journals.
We, of course, send it to Nature, and then Nature didn't want to have it.
Biologists didn't think economics had much to say about their field, and economists didn't want to hear from a biologist either.
In the usual, slightly arrogant way of economists, they say, well, we knew all this and we have all these models before.
But over time, Noé's biological market idea gained some traction.
If you go back to just this question of why does cooperation exist in nature, I think that this theory has been accepted as a really credible and correct explanation for why that is.
It picked up very slowly. These days, it's cited much more per year than it was in the early 5-6 years.
One of the biologists who picked up the idea and extended it way beyond primates was a student of Noé's.
My name is Redwa Amshari. I'm a professor in behavioral ecology. That means I study animal behavior.
Bashari teaches at the University of Neuchâtel in Switzerland. He started out doing fieldwork in Africa with Ronald Noé, and Bashari was good, really good.
He proposed to do experiments in the field, which is very difficult in a forest.
So I bought a leopard cloth to wrap around my body and approach monkeys and see how they respond.
And I said, well, if that works, it'll eat my head.
And who gives alarm calls first? Because I was studying mixed species associations.
And he actually did it, and he pulled it off.
So if I have it right, you're essentially climbing into trees wearing a kind of leopard skin coat? And no?
No, so a leopard is approaching over the forest floor, so I was stalking the monkeys.
Ah, okay.
So there are red colobus monkeys and Diana monkeys. They're not particularly famous for non-primatologists because they just occur in primary rainforests in Africa. They are difficult to observe, and that's why there are not that many people studying them.
But Bashari decided he did not want to spend his career wrapped up in a leopard skin in the hot jungle.
He had come into contact with somebody in our lab who worked in the Red Sea on fish.
And Bashari thought, hey, maybe scuba diving would be better than jungle stalking.
I really learned diving because of the project.
He camped out by the Red Sea in Egypt for a couple of months.
I lived in the middle of nowhere in a tent with a little straw roof above for protection against the sun. No fridge, so quite vegan eating. Apart from once a week, we go to the next village. And that was probably the only time in my life that I really enjoyed to go to McDonald's.
Once Bashari learned how to dive and started working on the coral reef, he discovered that this habitat was ideal for studying animal behavior.
The nice thing about a coral reef is that predator and prey, they live so close together that if you are there as a human, the fish don't really care about you. So you're immediately part of it. Whereas if you go studying monkeys in a rainforest, first of all, you spend 1 year habituating the monkeys to your presence before they hide from you. And once they are used to you, they're still 20 meters up in the trees, in the canopy. So it's very difficult to observe anything in a rainforest, whereas it's extremely easy in a coral reef.
One little fish captured Bashari's attention. It's called a cleaner wrasse. Wrasse is W-R-A-S-S-E.
So the cleaner wrasse is a small fish, 10 centimeters max, that lives from the Red Sea to Australia and the whole Indo-Pacific.
This particular wrasse is called a cleaner because of the rather unusual niche it fills on the coral reef.
These are the fish that essentially eat the parasites and dead scales off of other fish.
Little crustaceans or little flatworms that would eat either the mucus or the skin or the blood of the clients. That's obviously like a tick. And you don't want to swim around with ticks, so you go to a cleaner fish, and the cleaner fish then removes these parasites.
Each cleaner wrasse sets up shop at a particular spot on the reef, kind of like a string of car washes, and the client fish line up at their favorite station to have their parasites removed.
That's the reason of being, so to speak, in a coral reef. From sunrise to sunset, 11 hours, they clean. They have 2,000 interactions per day. And a single client typically goes 5 to 30 times a day to see a cleaner fish.
The cleaner wrasse will even service predators like the barracuda.
One of the scariest looking fishes in the ocean, it's got like a crocodile mouth with needle sharp teeth. And the cleaner wrasse will go in its mouth and eat the parasites from between its teeth.
So Redwan Bashari was hanging out underwater at the coral reef watching all this cleaner wrasse action, and he began to observe patterns. For one thing, there were two different types of client fish. There were the fish with limited range who had access to just one cleaner wrasse. Bashari called these fish residents. He compares them to people who live out in the country.
You live in a little village. There's one hairdresser. If you want to have your hair cut, you go to this one hairdresser, or you don't have your hair cut at all.
And then there were the fish with more range who had their pick of many cleaning stations. If they didn't like the service they got at one, they could choose another. And these fish, Bashari called visitors.
So this is like the big city life.
In other words, if you don't like one hairdresser, you can find another one nearby. And the cleaner fish know the difference between visitors and residents.
What's incredible here is the cleaner wrasses themselves are able to recognize and understand which species of fishes have other options. And they will actually tailor their level of service depending on the competition.
For instance, They might make a resident fish wait while they service a visitor, knowing that a visitor might take his business elsewhere if there's a line.
And that's exactly what visitors are doing. If the service is good, there's a high chance that you go back to the same station for your next inspection. If the service is lousy, you go to a different station for your next inspection.
They also provide another service too, which is they use their fins to basically like massage the fish they're servicing. And the predators receive way more tactile stimulation from the cleaner wrasses than the non-predators, and like the residents receive much less.
This was exactly what Bashari had been looking for. The client fish were choosing their partners, and the cleaner fish were dialing their service up or down in response to the amount of choice that each client had. And, as economic theory would predict, the client fish with more choice reaped greater benefits.
Obviously, I was extremely excited. I was hoping for this market effect.
But there is a central tension between cleaner wrasses and their clients. Eating parasites and dead scales is all well and good, but that is not what the cleaner wrasse truly wants.
It actually prefers to take a bite of healthy scales or healthy mucus.
This mucus, this is what makes the fish so slimy.
Tastes better, it's probably more nutritious.
That's actually quite nutritious. The mucus protects the skin and the scales of the fish.
But if it does that, it hurts the fish will probably swim away.
So the client obviously has no interest whatsoever that the cleaner fish eats the mucus. And so there's this conflict of interest. The cleaner fish wants to eat mucus, the client wants the cleaner fish to eat parasites, and therefore the clients have to find means to make the cleaner fish eat against its preference.
So what happens? Bashari found that the cleaner wrasse is much more likely to cheat and take mucus from a resident fish, the kind that can't just move his business to another cleaner.
It's like monopoly power. They can extract a higher price, whereas, you know, in a more open market where the fish can travel and shop, they have to raise the quality of service, so they're more gentle.
Here is something else Bashari found. If the supply of cleaner wrasses in a given area decreased, the remaining cleaners had more leverage.
So when Bashari would manipulate conditions in the reef, if he like just took half of the wrasses out of the reef, the ones that remained immediately started taking more bites from their clients.
But the clients do have recourse. If a cleaner wrasse takes too big of a bite, the client will chase the cleaner fish away.
And the cleaner fish will remember that this particular client chased it. And when this particular client comes back 20 minutes later, half an hour later, the cleaner fish will remember, okay, here, my relationship with this client is not particularly good. So I have to make up for the bad service last time. And the cleaner fish will give this resident a particularly good service.
And there's no doubt in your mind that they really do remember the individual fish.
Yeah, we did experiments on this. Yeah.
Redwan Bashari has by now spent 2 decades studying the cleaner wrasse, long enough to convince him and his fellow animal behaviorists that they plainly engage in what humans would recognize as economic transactions. And there's growing evidence that biological markets exist across a very wide range of animals. Paper wasps, for instance. They live in nests that are controlled by a single queen, and they earn their keep by foraging for food. But they're free to go work in another nest if they'd like. Ben Crayer again.
Its labor is sort of the price it pays to get into a nest. If you suddenly double the number of nests, the price should go down.
And that is exactly what researchers found. When the number of nests in a given area rose, the worker wasps could get away with foraging less.
The dominant breeders were suddenly willing to tolerate smaller contributions in terms of the amount of time the subordinates were spending in the field foraging.
So is it like when the unemployment rate goes down, wages go up?
I've thought about it more in terms of like a real estate market. So when there's a larger supply of homes available on the market, the price of rent is cheaper. And when that supply is really restricted, the price of rent goes up.
Perhaps the purest biological market, at least according to Ben Crayer, lies outside the animal kingdom.
They're underground markets between the roots of plants and fungi.
As you may remember from high school, fungi are really good at harvesting nutrients from the soil, like nitrogen and phosphorus, while plants are good at turning sunlight and carbon dioxide into sugar molecules.
So both parties give some molecules that the other needs.
That, again, is the biologist Ronald Noe.
Those markets are, in fact, nutrient exchange markets.
A fungus-to-plant nutrient exchange is, of course, pretty far from what we humans think of as markets. There's no cognition going on there, or at least what we think of as cognition. Doesn't trade require an intention to trade? What about all the emotions that accompany intention? Perhaps, but for Ronald Noe, that is what makes biological markets more rational than human ones.
Homo economicus, I don't think exists really in humans because they're not that rational. But natural selection can, of course, end up with, after many, many generations and a lot of selection, you can end up with an organism that is doing things that look very rational. It's not using reason, of course. It's using innate mechanisms, but it is programmed to do things that look very rational. Let's put it that way.
That's so interesting. So as I'm sure you well know, this year, Richard Thaler won the Nobel in Economics for essentially arguing that Homo economicus is greatly overrated. You're saying that Homo economicus is really, that the idea of that is probably more fully present in other animals other than humans then, yeah?
Yeah, you should leave out the homo part and you're going, okay. I think the less you use cognitive mechanisms, the least brain you have. If you have no neurons, you have a better chance of being very rational in your behavior than when you use them. When you use your brain, you can make all kinds of mistakes.
What you just said is a summary of what's attracted me to economics and behavioral economics these last 20 years, because the anomalies or the holes in the rational theory has been pointed out. But when you say it like that, it kind of blows me away, because you're basically saying that the more we think, the more capacity we have for cognitive, you know, activity or decision making, the more likely we are to be less rational. Yeah,
There is, of course, a big advantage of using a brain for all kinds of solutions. You're very plastic. You can react to all kinds of novel situations. And things without brains, like bacteria, fungi, or whatever, cannot react instantly to all kinds of different situations. They are well selected to act in a certain environment. If they are in that environment, however, then they are very good at it. They are selected to do exactly the right thing in thousands to millions of generations, to do the right thing in the right moment. And in that respect, if you look at that and you would say, well, how would a human react in the same kind of situation? In the most rational way, he would do exactly the same as that fungus or that bacterium.
Thinking about Ronald Noe's argument for the intense rationality of biological markets, I went back to Keith Chen, the economist. In light of the biological evidence, I wanted to take one more run at his answer about what sets us apart from other animals. You know, obviously, they don't do as much as we do. They don't drive cars. They don't write down math and so on. And how much of it was an exhibition of, I guess, you know, human triumphalism or species superiority, that you just assume that because we're the humans and they're the animals, there's this whole set of economic-like activity that, of course, they're not going to be able to do? How much of it was that, do you think?
Yeah. I guess it would be natural to think that animals can't engage in very rich economic activity, because you just look out at the animal kingdom and you just typically don't see very rich economic activity, right? But when you start to actually test those assumptions by bringing animals into the laboratory and just try and create the conditions for them to learn economic trade and subtle aspects of reputation maintenance and cheater detection and cheating punishment, is that it doesn't take very much. That adding just very thin layers of institutions for trust, adding very thin layers which allow the emergence of abstract money, just immediately engender very, very rich economic activity, even among monkeys.
So when I asked you at the beginning, what is it that makes us human, makes humans human, your answer was basically, you know, trade. But you've spent a lot of your economic research life disproving your very argument, haven't you?
Giving me a hard time here. I think that's right. I feel like I have an endowment effect towards my earlier answer, and I'm going to kind of like, it's going to feel painful to give, it's going to feel painful to give up on it, but absolutely.
Nobody ever saw a dog make a fair and deliberate exchange of one bone for another with another dog. That was Adam Smith's contention. I think we can all agree that if this sentiment isn't outright wrong, it's certainly not quite right. And since Smith was picking on dogs specifically, we'll give the last word today to one of my very favorite dog experts, again, on the question of what sets humans apart.
I'm Alexandra Horowitz. I'm a researcher and professor at Barnard College, where I run the Dog Cognition Lab. We study the sensory and cognitive abilities of dogs, with my aim to be to understand what it might be like to be a dog.
Horowitz has written a couple of fascinating books, Inside of a Dog and Being a Dog.
I've studied and taught animal cognition and comparative psychology for decades. And this question, what's the one thing that distinguishes humans from non-human animals, is clearly the driving force of much research. We might trace it back to Plato, who described man as a featherless biped. But the smart aleck Diogenes then plucked a chicken and said triumphantly, "Here is Plato's man." To which Plato simply pivoted, adding, "Okay, a featherless biped with broad nails, not claws." And so it has been since, trying to find the feature that will verify the human species' uniqueness. It's imitation, it's culture, it's teaching, it's language, it's a theory of mind, each confidently proposed and then collapsing under the weight of actual evidence. The one thing that makes humans human? Our obsession with asking and answering this question. As far as I know, we're the only species so concerned with distinguishing ourselves from other animals. Of course, research could prove me wrong.
Touché, Alexandra Horowitz, and thank you. Coming up next on Freakonomics Radio, one of our favorite listener questions ever. Is it really in a restaurant's best interest to give customers free bread or chips before they even order?
Why not have the customer order their own appetizer and pay for it?
And for more episodes like this one, please check out our podcast archive on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts, or at Freakonomics.com, where you'll also find our books, the blog, and much more.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio with your host, Stephen Dubner.
They're fried and thin and crispy and super salty.
Chewy, and it's salty, and they coat the top of it with olive oil.
So you've got kind of a crunch and a soft and then a bite of butter. I mean, how do you not love that?
They like the idea of drinks and chips and salsa as even a meal. And it's endless, so they could definitely spend most of their stomach real estate there.
Yeah, from a restaurant perspective, I don't think it makes much sense to do that.
I'm not sure. You know, it really doesn't make much sense.
Hey, Freakonomics. This is Larry Tingen, a math instructor at Cape Fear Community College in Wilmington, North Carolina. My fiancé, Kelly, and I went out to a Mexican restaurant, and the first thing that happened was a server brought us chips and salsa. Totally normal. Happens every time. I didn't think anything about it. Suddenly, Kelly, my fiancé, asked me, why do they give us free chips and salsa? This led to a long conversation, but no matter how hard we tried, we couldn't square the circle. To us, it seems to go against the restaurant's financial interests because people always fill up on the free food, which leads them to order a smaller and cheaper meal. As we walked out of the restaurant, we were thinking, what's going on here? When we got back to the car, the last Freakonomics podcast was playing, and I said to Kelly, I know who we should ask.
All right, Larry, we'll bite. Why do some restaurants give you free chips and salsa when you sit down, or a basket of bread, or maybe some olives, or pickles, or other amuse-bouche? Say it with me, amuse-bouche.
I'm not sure it is good logic.
I try not to fill up on it because I want the rest of the food that's on the menu.
I really don't know what it is, but I'm not a restaurant person.
The amuse-bouche.
No, this little amuse-bouche.
Amuse-bouche.
Amuse-bouche. Something that makes the mouth happy. Now, on the surface, this practice may appear to work against a restaurant's self-interest. They're trying to sell you food, not give it to you. But does it really work against their self-interest? And if not, why not? Let's say this from the start. It will be hard to come up with definitive answers to these questions. We looked for good data and research findings on the topic, and, well, we were left hungry. But we'll still do our best. We'll talk to a professor at Cornell.
My name is Mike Lynn.
He's a professor of consumer behavior and marketing. You may remember Michael Lynn from our episode on tipping a while back. We also hear from a number of people who work in restaurants.
I think that food definitely makes a lot of difference in people's moods, their energy levels, everything. And I think as a server, you have to constantly be aware of that.
Including Nancy Silverton, a winner of the Outstanding Chef Award from the James Beard Foundation.
I am the founder of La Brea Bakery, which is an international bread company now. And I am the co-owner of several restaurants.
We also talked to a lot of people like you and me, people who eat in restaurants.
They gave us chips and guacamole and salsa.
They didn't give us bread for free? No. I guess they didn't give us anything for free.
And if it's good and if it's quality, I'm very willing to pay for it. Like, if I don't want it, don't give it to me.
So let's get into the various explanations, shall we? One popular theory among diners for why it doesn't make sense for restaurants to give you free food at the beginning of the meal has to do with what happens at the end of the meal.
It always seems stupid to me to bring a bread basket because they're just going to fill up and then they're not going to have dessert.
I personally think it's kind of stupid because then people don't order dessert, and dessert's my favorite thing.
But what if
it may not be in the restaurant's interest to sell you dessert?
That's Michael Lynn.
After all, dessert is a relatively low-priced item. You're going to occupy a table. If they've got enough other customers who'd be willing to order entrees, they'd be better off turning that table rather than selling you a dessert. And so I suppose you could argue maybe that's a reason to give away free chips. They'll fill up, they'll get their meal, and then they won't order dessert. And that's good from the restaurant's perspective because then they can fill that table with another person who's going to order an expensive entree.
But at relatively high-end restaurants, like Nancy Silverton's...
A dessert can be as high as $12, right? So that's an item. We're making money on that.
Okay, so the dessert theory may or may not make sense. Here's another explanation for free appetizers. This one we heard especially from restaurant servers.
Yeah, the free bread, it will keep them entertained for a couple minutes while you take care of anything you need to take care of.
Then I don't have to deal with, you know, an angry, hungry person, hangry person.
And the last thing you want is someone to be sitting at the table, irritable, hungry, waiting to have their order taken, and all of that can be solved with just this little free carb on the table.
And that also is a very plausible argument. We know from research, again, on waiting that perceptions of speed and service increase customer satisfaction. Although, why not have the customer order their own appetizer and pay for it? I mean, if the customer cares so much about that downtime while they're waiting for their order, then they're willing, they'll pay for it, right? And if they don't care so enough to pay for it, it obviously isn't going to bother them that much. Why give them something free? They can talk to one another.
Nancy Silverton says that in her restaurants, which are in California and Singapore, they do serve free bread, but after customers have ordered. Why? Here's one reason.
If someone comes in really hungry and there's nothing on the table, they'll order quicker, eat and leave, and then you can turn that table rather than if you give them something to sort of nosh on while they're reading the menu, they're not going to order as quickly.
So it may be that free bread helps the servers get their job done, which is good for the restaurant, Or it may be that free bread slows down the ordering process, which is bad for the restaurant. You see how this is working out, don't you? It may not be so simple to understand why restaurants give you free food. So, okay, here's another theory. How do you like this one?
People are drinking, you know, margaritas and such. You know, that salty, like, chips or whatever might influence people to drink more, I think.
If it's very salty, it does encourage them to order more drinks.
You've probably heard this idea before, right? Many restaurants make a bigger margin from drinks than food, so anything that makes you thirstier might work in the restaurant's favor. Michael Lin, however, is skeptical.
Your theory really needs to say, look, somehow getting this free thing of chips is likely to cause me to choose a beverage, because I'm going to have some kind of beverage, but to choose a beverage that the restaurant profits from more than a beverage like water that they don't make much off of. Is there a good reason to believe that that happens?
Okay, so whether or not the chips or bread let the restaurant upsell you on drinks, what about upselling you on food? That is, instead of thinking of the free bread as a substitute for the food you may buy, what if it's a compliment?
By the way, the technician in the other room here has another theory. And his theory is that, well, eating's addictive. Once I get started, it's hard to stop.
Yeah, you prime the pump.
And so if they do give you chips before you order, it's priming the pump and it's getting you started so that you'll then subsequently order more.
In this scenario, it really helps that the food the restaurant is giving you is free. Why?
Free has a special attraction and appeal to us. Dan Ariely and some of his colleagues did a study where they offered students on campus a choice. They could purchase a fancy Lindt chocolate for 15 cents or, alternatively, a Hershey's Kiss for 1 cent. Now, when given that option, roughly 70% of the students chose to buy the fancier chocolate.
But then Ariely and his colleagues subtracted 1 penny from the price of each chocolate. So the price difference was the same, but now the Hershey's Kiss was free.
Preferences switch so that about 70% or 2/3 of the students in this condition chose the free Hershey Kiss. That's a nice study in demonstrating that there's just some special appeal to getting stuff free. So part of what may be going on is simply that by giving away free items, you're increasing the appeal of what you have to offer to the public.
So maybe we like the restaurant a bit more when they give us free food, and maybe we want to reciprocate somehow. Maybe by ordering as much food as we would have ordered if they hadn't given us the bread basket. Some researchers have called this a consumption norm or an ordering script that people don't deviate from whether they get some free bread or not, which might indicate the free food isn't necessarily working in the restaurant's favor. That might lead you to wonder if restaurants do this just to keep up with other restaurants.
If there's going to be an arms race, then there's some economic benefit to giving it as long as no one else is. So let's assume everybody's charging for chips. If I start giving them away free, am I going to get some competitive advantage? Absolutely, I think. And that's then going to put pressure on other restaurants to start doing it because my competitive advantage is their competitive disadvantage.
Now, if you are giving away food for free, you do have to have some faith that customers won't simply gobble up the free stuff and leave.
It would be kind of awkward to go into a restaurant, eat the chips and salsa, and then say, thanks.
My friends would go to a restaurant just to get the free chips and salsa and then leave.
Really?
Yeah. I wouldn't do it, though. I promise.
But, of course, some people just can't help themselves.
Oh, yeah, definitely. As a college student, I definitely overindulged in bread baskets at restaurants. There's those people who come in all the time that we'd recognize, and they'd sample everything and then leave.
It's like Red Lobster's cheese biscuits are awesome.
Cheesy biscuits?
The cheesy garlic biscuits? Oh, my God.
Put that in your purse, you know? Just keep getting cheesy biscuits and just stuffing them suckers right down in there.
So we've talked through some of the reasons why many restaurants give away free food, but coming up on Freakonomics Radio, there are some deeper questions we haven't gotten to yet.
Are you really getting it free, or is the price of those chips, that bread, being built into the menu cost? And then the question is, why would you build it in to the menu price rather than charging separately for it?
And maybe this whole free appetizer thing is the result of nothing more than an accident of history.
So free bread becomes a part of that tradition. It was food that you could snack on between courses, but also meant that you were eating less of the expensive fishes and meat.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Today on Freakonomics Radio, we are wondering why restaurants give you free food the minute you sit down, before you've spent a penny. That bread basket, or the chips and salsa, that little shot glass of kale and melon smoothie.
Gosh, Italian restaurants, Mexican restaurants, some of our favorites. In fact, I think we fuss when they charge for such things.
I don't like the charging. It should come with it, you know? It should come with the meal, like, yeah.
Being in the restaurant industry, I did have a couple a few weeks ago actually tell me because we did not do bread service where I worked, they wouldn't be back.
We try to offer it because that's what people expect.
And from personal experience, when that doesn't happen, people get really mad.
You know, a lot of restaurants in Europe, they do have like a table charge, which covers things like bread. We don't do that here. And actually, when we first opened, we didn't serve bread, and there was such an outrage or angry guest. So I kind of caved and said, I guess we have to serve bread.
All right, so we've come to expect that free bread when we sit down. But why? Where does this expectation come from? We need to ask someone who knows a little food history. How about you? Yes, you, sir. Please tell everyone your name.
I am Andrew Haley.
And what do you do for a living?
I'm an associate professor of American cultural history at the University of Southern Mississippi.
Do you have some particular area of research that's germane to our conversation today?
I study the history of food and restaurants.
Perfect. All right then, Professor Haley, tell us what you know about the history of restaurants.
People have been dining out for as long as they've been traveling, and so there have been taverns and hostels that provided food. But the modern restaurant has two early manifestations. It appeared in China first, but that remained localized to China. More famously, it emerged in France in the late 18th century.
Now, these early restaurants weren't serving free bread, were they?
These early restaurants were serving free breads, but I think the free bread probably predates the restaurant itself. Before there were restaurants, there were taverns. Taverns served a set dinner at a set time for a set price. And the accounts we have of these tavern meals suggest that bread, probably prepared by a local baker rather than the tavern owner, was part of the meal. And this made sense, after all. When you went to one of these taverns, you were paying for the meal with a single charge. And it was in the interest of the tavern owner that you filled yourself up with bread so that you would eat less of the expensive fishes and meats.
Wow, that does make sense. Economic sense in particular, for a tavern at least. But what about these early restaurants?
Early restaurants pick up that tradition, and they serve these table d'hote meals, these fixed-priced meals. And they have the same incentive as the taverns before them. Since the price of the meal is all-inclusive, they want you to fill up on bread, and so free bread becomes a part of that tradition. And it's not just bread. They also sometimes provide crackers or pickles and olives.
Andrew Haley, we should say here, is the author of a fascinating book called Turning the Tables, Restaurants and the Rise of the American Middle Class. In it, he makes the point that while fixed price menus are still around, it is the a la carte menu, or a modified a la carte, that most of us are familiar with. He attributes this to the explosion of the middle class.
So over the course of the 19th century, restaurants initially served these table d'hôte menus to the very wealthy, who were able to pretty much pay the set price and not worry too much about it. But by the mid and late 19th century, restaurants are trying to attract middle-class diners, and middle-class diners are more cost-conscious. They want to be able to kind of pick and choose from the menu so that they can dine out more affordably. You would imagine that these a la carte restaurants began to charge for bread, but it seems that the tradition of eating bread was extremely well established. And so when we look at these a la carte menus, we don't see bread listed. It's just assumed that the bread will be on the table.
Okay, so the bread stays in the picture, for starters at least. But as Haley argues, more middle-class diners meant more restaurants. And what did that mean?
Restaurants are facing a lot of competition in the early 20th century. There's just more and more of them, and they are eager to attract this somewhat frugal middle class. And so they're looking for ways to keep their prices down. And one of the things that they do is they introduce some New York restaurants, especially New York hotel restaurants, in 1913, introduce a couvert, a cover charge of 10 cents, which is to cover bread and water and any of the other free things at the table. And this is met with resistance.
When Haley says this was met with resistance, he doesn't mean just one or two grumpy customers.
Coverage in the New York Times in 1913 of this is somewhat incredulous that restaurants would actually try to charge for bread. Patrons are incredibly upset about the couvert charge. These patrons claim that it is a un-American European import, and they complain about the charge and in some cases bring their own bread to the restaurant to resist the charge. And it appears that restaurants cave pretty quickly and stop charging for bread. And so I think that it's indicative of the fact that the tradition of free bread had become very well established in American restaurants.
But you know what? Fast forward to today, and that tradition seems to be on the wane for a couple of reasons. One, now as before, is cost.
We are one of the growing number of restaurants that do not give away free bread or snacks or food.
Comes down to cutting cost.
I think the reason why they just don't do it anymore is the same reason why a lot of people started cutting back. Even at the fast food restaurants, you see food is getting smaller. It's to cut back costs. So they had to take the freebies. They had to take the freebies.
A restaurant, as you have undoubtedly heard, is a notoriously risky business. Here again is chef and restaurateur Nancy Silverton.
A restaurant that struggles needs to do everything to tighten their costs. You know, they have to cut down on labor. They might have to cut down on the types of tableware they use or the types of napkins they use, you know, and you start cutting those costs just to survive. And I would say that probably one of the first things to go is bread service. It's sort of an added value item, right? I mean, it's not something somebody's ordering. And so here is something that's on the table that people don't really appreciate. It is a food cost.
But Silverton says there's another reason why she's seeing less free bread in restaurants.
I see on menus, it's not on ours, but I see on menus, at the bottom of the menu, bread upon request, which is sort of interesting because there's a lot of people that are either, say, not eating carbs. A lot of people are trying to stay away from gluten, say. So there are a lot of people, I would say, that are not bread eaters these days. I happen to be not one of them.
So there's one way that restaurants could stop serving free bread or chips if it's costing them too much. They could simply say, hey, people, we're helping keep you from getting fat. Michael Lynn has another idea.
Why aren't chips simply an item on the menu just like everything else?
So, as you said, there's a growing literature on free and what it means and what it accomplishes. And some of the effects are really strong and interesting there. I think what's different about this scenario is, let's say I want to buy a car and the car dealer offers me a free something. You know, if it's a really high-end car, maybe they offer me free tickets to a ball game or whatever it is. That's nice, but it theoretically doesn't diminish my demand for the product itself. In fact, it might increase it. I get a new car, it makes it easier to drive to the game. In this case, however, the free thing would seem to be working against the paid thing itself. So it's, you're literally giving me some of the stuff that I'm prepared to give you money for, but you're giving me a portion of that stuff free.
Another way of looking at this is, are you really getting it free, or is the price of those chips, that bread, being built into the menu cost? And then the question is, why would you build it in to the menu price rather than charging separately for it? Okay? And there are a couple of answers here too. One is, we know from research that people don't like being nickeled and dimed, and that if you add too many surcharges onto a bundle that people are purchasing, they become turned off and are less likely to purchase the bundle. So one reason that people may offer the free chips is to avoid this appearance of nickel and diming the customer.
What restaurants may be trying to avoid, Michael Lin says, is too much of what is called price partitioning.
What happens when we have separate prices, and how do people evaluate separate prices relative to one common price?
Lin says consumers generally aren't crazy about too many separate prices for one product, like an airline ticket, then a fee to check your bags, and a fee to eat or watch a movie, then the pillow fee, the pillow insurance fee. Okay, I made that last one up. There's no such thing as pillow insurance yet, but you get the idea. So if a restaurant can bake the price of the appetizer into the menu prices, it might make perfect sense to give it away. Nancy Silverton again.
You figure that out ahead of time, what it costs to operate your restaurant. So that means, what does linen cost? What does health insurance cost? What does bread cost? And you tag that percentage onto what you have to upcharge your food so that you make the amount of money you need to make to be a successful restaurant, you know. And so it's true, that bread is figured into the cost.
In other words, all the questions we've been asking today about why restaurants give you free food were probably the wrong questions, because the food isn't free. Or, as the late, great Milton Friedman might have put it, there ain't no such thing as a free appetizer. I'm Stephen Dubner. Coming up next time on Freakonomics Radio, it's finally here. The event you've been waiting for 4 years.
The World Cup is a global eclipse, it's been called, that just cast its shadow across the whole world for an entire month at the same time, everywhere apart from America.
We'll talk about why you, even if you're American, even if you hate soccer or know nothing about it, why you should pay attention to the upcoming Men's Soccer World Cup in Russia. There's the pageantry.
If they're offering odds, I'd do 1 to 5 odds, honestly. If Ronaldo, I mean, shirtless at some point.
Uh-huh.
Even win or lose, he would take his shirt off.
And Putin, you think is?
I say Evans.
There's the beauty of fair play.
I think is the combination of running a monopoly that is accountable to none. The point is that it's not a fair game.
And, of course, there's the opportunity to disrupt your daily routine.
I think America loves a circus. They love nothing more than an excuse to cut work en masse for an entire month and daytime drink. What an alluring possibility for any American. You know, if you are in a bar at 7 o'clock in the morning with a Budweiser, society frowns on that, right, Stephen Dibler?
Yes.
Yeah, but if you're in that same bar with that same Budweiser and on the television, Spain are playing Portugal in the opening group game of the World Cup. What are you?
You're a football fan.
You're a football fan.
How to catch World Cup fever? It's next time on Freakonomics Radio. Thank you so much for listening. We will be back next week. If you can't wait that long, you can find our entire Freakonomics Radio podcast archive at freakonomics.com or at Apple Podcasts, where you can also subscribe.